From Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology News, this is the GenCast Network. Bringing you compelling and in-depth interviews with the biotech industry's leading researchers, newsmakers, and thought leaders. This week on the GenCast Network. Gen's Editor-in-Chief John Sterling interviews Dr. Peter Navarro of the Paul Mirage School of Business at the University of California, Irvine, about the pitfalls of doing biotech research and development and manufacturing in China.
Dr. Peter Navarro is a business professor in the Paul Mirage School of Business at the University of California in Irvine. Dr. Navarro holds a PhD in economics from Harvard, is the author of a number of books, including When the Market Moves, Will You Be Ready?, The Well-Timed Strategy, and The Coming China Wars. Where will they be fought, and how can they be won? Dr. Navarro, in your book, The Coming China Wars, the wars you refer to are not military ones, but rather battles over decent jobs, livable wages, and leading-edge technologies. Would you summarize the main points of your book?
China is on a collision course right now with the rest of the world because of its rapid rate of growth. It's been growing 10% annually in its GDP for the last three decades. It's doubled its economy three times in that period. And the problem is that it's relying, unlike other countries like India, on a heavy manufacturing model and growing at a rate that it is unsustainable. And the conflicts that I talk about in the Coming China Wars book are wide-ranging. They include, for example, intellectual property and the whole counterfeiting and piracy issue. China is the counterfeit capital of the world, and it regularly steals from corporations worldwide. Number two, the environment. China has emerged now, surpassed the U.S. as the biggest global warmer. The air we breathe here in America now is tainted by the Asian brown cloud. Virtually any city you go to in China is severely polluted, and that pollution does not stay within China's borders. In Africa and Latin America, China has mounted a very aggressive imperialist offensive to gain control of the natural resources of those countries. China uses half of the world's cement, a third of its steel, a fourth of its copper, a fifth of its aluminum, and in order to get that, it's engaged in some very questionable practices. Oil is a biggie. We're hitting towards $100 barrel oil. Our gas prices are up. Again, the U.S. Is the largest consumer of oil, but China's demand is rapidly growing. And what's disturbing about that is how China goes about securing its oil reserves, basically cutting deals with either traditional U.S. suppliers or rogue nations or both, Venezuela, Iran, Sudan, etc. And then the overarching thing I think we have to understand about China, and it's very critical, the popular myth is that China's competitive advantage derives simply from its cheap labor. But in fact, the research I've done, I did a one-year research project at the University of California, Irvine, studying this question, and found that almost half of China's competitive advantage actually is related to unfair trading practices. The big five include currency manipulation, export subsidies that are illegal under the WTO, counterfeiting and piracy that saves them in terms of R&D and IT expenses, and then lax environmental regulations and lax health and safety regulations. So bottom line is, well, the U.S. is focused on the Middle East. The economic threat from Asia and principally China has been largely ignored, and we as a country have not dealt with that in a policy way.
Now, within the context of this growing power of China as an economic power, you maintain that China has an ongoing mercantilist economic development policy, not just in manufacturing, but in a, quote, march up the value chain. Would you explain what you mean by mercantilist and march up the value chain?
Yeah, this is fascinating, actually. Let's start with the value chain idea. I mean, if you look at the evolution of China, it started out simply as a, not a factory floor, but simply an assembly floor. But what it's doing now is it's steadily moving across the value chain, meaning that it doesn't just assemble, it does manufacturing, it's moving back into actual design of products. And then moving up the value chain used to be just cheap electronics and cheaper toys that China made, but now it's steadily moving up the chain into your favorite subject, biopharma, into auto production. One of the most amazing statistics that Americans don't really know is that China actually, right now, already produces more cars than the United States, when you exclude light trucks and SUVs, and then into aircraft. So the higher up the value chain you go, the better the jobs, the better the wages, the more prosperous a country. The more across the value chain, the same thing goes. So in many ways, it's a zero-sum game. As they move up and across the value chain, it comes at the expense of jobs in other countries around the world, whether it's Europe, European countries, or the U.S., or Mexico, or Bangladesh. Now, all's fair in free trade? I think not. I mean, the whole idea of free trade is that it's got to be fair trade. And mercantilism is a doctrine practiced a couple of centuries ago, basically where countries would try to prosper by simply exporting goods to other countries so that they would prosper at the expense of the other countries. And the mercantilist doctrine very much applies to China because most of its growth now is clearly export-driven. Now, the mercantilist policies, a.k.a. the unfair trading practices policies they use, include, and we can talk a little bit about these in more detail now. We start with currency manipulation. They grossly undervalue their currency by setting a fixed peg to the dollar. This has the practical effect of levying a stiff tariff on U.S. companies that want to export to China at the same time that it provides a strong stimulus to U.S. consumers when they buy Chinese goods. So that alone creates a situation where trade imbalances are an issue. Now, right now we have $250 billion annual trade imbalance with China. Part of it is the currency manipulation. Number two, the World Trade Organization, China joined them in 2001, and when they did that, they agreed to abide by the WTO rules of the road. They have not done that. In fact, they lavish export subsidies on their industries. In addition to that, if you go over to China, if you're a domestic company, you're going to get subsidized energy, you're going to get subsidized or free land. And one of the biggest things they do is essentially dole out free money. They basically will lend money to Chinese companies without any expectation that would ever pay back. And a U.S. company cannot compete against that. Third thing is, in terms of the mercantilist policies, counterfeiting and piracy. A lot of people, when they think about that, they think of Louis Vuitton purses and Hollywood movies, and it's like, who cares? But, in fact, if a company in China can basically steal the research and development fruit of, say, a pharmaceutical company or an auto company, they save a tremendous amount relative to their competitor. If they don't have to pay for information technology expenses, ditto. And if they don't have to spend a lot of money on advertising to market their brand because they're sending out counterfeits, same thing. So that's an unfair trade advantage. And then the lax health and safety and environmental regulations. I mean, China is the most polluted country in the world. It's the most dangerous country in the world to work. Those companies that don't have to abide by the rules of our EPA or our OSHA save a bunch of money, and they're able, basically, to compete. Now, what I did in that research study, I called it the China Price Project. You'll go to my website, peternavarro.com. You can download the whole report. What I did was I quantified the contribution of each of those five mercantilist practices to the China price advantage, and basically determine that almost half of that advantage is pure unfair trading practices.
Now, with this background, let's focus on biotech and pharmaceuticals. You say that biotechnology and pharmaceuticals might be the most instructive case examples of these concepts of mercantilist economic development policy and march up the value chain as they apply to China. Can you elaborate on that a bit?
Yeah. Right now, I'm in Southern California. I live in Orange County, but I spent a lot of time some years ago in San Diego, where biotech basically there is the great hope of that whole county for decent jobs. San Diego County is a place where there's just not a lot of high value added activity going on. They lost their aerospace industry a long time ago, and it's basically construction jobs and tourism. So biotech is held up kind of as a shining example of how San Diego might build a county. The problem right now is that San Diego and all the other biotech centers in the U.S. Are actually getting hammered by China because biopharma basically is getting offshored to China. Now, that's high up the value chain. That's not making toys. That's not making cheap electronic circuits. Those are good jobs. And the products that industry generates have high profit margins, and they're very important industries for any economy. Now, China basically is able to attract biopharma for a whole bunch of reasons. If you look simply at the cost of the drug development, it's just a lot cheaper to go over there to set up labs, number one. Number two, the industry over there is not constrained as they might be or as they are here in the U.S. by the FDA and other regulations that prohibit or put restrictions on things like human and animal testing or cloning or whatever. So it's much more of an open atmosphere there. And then the combination of the cheap labor, the cheap lab costs, the cheap drug development costs, and the lax regulatory environment. And then add one more thing onto that. The Chinese government basically is doubling down on this industry. I mean, as bad as they subsidize other industries that Americans are trying to compete with, they're just throwing all sorts of money at biopharma, setting up R&D centers and things like that. So we're seeing this big shift of biopharma over to Asia and principally China.
Now, you'd mentioned before problems with piracy and counterfeit products. What about patent piracy and counterfeit products as they relate to biotech and pharma firms over there? What's going on? What the company?
Well,
need to be aware
your audience is presumably biopharma managers, executives, middle management, whatever. My message clearly today, as they listen to this, is that you need to do your risk assessment. American companies right now are not adequately evaluating the high risks of going to China, and that can come back to bite you. Now, the first big problem for an industry like biopharma is the loss of intellectual property. I mean, that's the bread and butter of biopharma. I mean, you invent something or discover something, and if it's stolen, the tens of millions of dollars that you put into that, and all the blood, sweat, and tears and years you put into that, can be vaporized. The Chinese have absolutely no qualms about stealing anything from anybody, and that theft is facilitated by very lax intellectual property laws and enforcement in the host country. I don't know just how prevalent it has become in biopharma, but I can give you a typical example in other industries. I mean, if you go over there with a design and say, hey, we want to make this design for export to the world market, you'll find a Chinese contractor who will be willing to do that. And the next thing you know, they'll be running 3 8-hour shifts, and the two shifts will meet your needs, and the third shift will basically be out the door. They call it the ghost shift, and selling that product under your label through a counterfeit chain. Very typical. And then over time, what happens is all the people making that product in the factory, they'll leave and form their own factory and sell it under a different brand or maybe even under your brand without your permission. So that's a real issue. Now, there's some other issues. I mean, as we saw with Mattel and the toys, Mattel actually is a poster child for a responsible company operating in China. I mean, they had years of experience there. They did everything right, and they still got burned. That can happen in biopharma. It can happen at the factory level. I mean, if you start shipping out pharmaceuticals with impurities or poor quality products because you don't have adequate quality control, that could kill a product or a company in a heartbeat.
What about counterfeit products? Again, not just for the consumer who may be taking these drugs, but say a drug that is labeled by an American European firm is made in China and has problems. So wouldn't that be a problem both for consumer and producer?
Yeah, it's a huge problem. And here's the thing. You go over there, these multinational companies go over there, and they bring with them highly sophisticated technologies to make the pills or capsules or liquids for injection or whatever it is, right? And in addition, they bring equally sophisticated packaging machinery, basically. And basically what they've done at that point is give the Chinese the capability, essentially, to counterfeit that product. I mean, there's issues. The Chinese are so good at replicating drugs that the companies that actually make those drugs have to chemically test the fakes in order to detect them. They can't just look at the packaging or look at the pill and determine it's a fake. It's so precise that the only way it can be done is through more complex testing. It's a huge problem. And the thing about it is, what you also do when you go over there is you give them your distribution chain. So they're able to find ways to take the counterfeit and distribute it into world markets, whether it's over the internet or into discount drugstores here in the U.S. I mean, there's documented cases of fake Lipitor, fake Novosk, drugs that women take for osteoporosis. don't think that you're going to be able to contain that problem when you go over to China. You're a stranger in a strange land over there.
You also note that the offshoring of biopharma to China has important implications for U.S. education and economic development. What are those implications?
Well, take a look at UC San Diego. Okay, UC San Diego, kids want to go to UC San Diego so that they can study science, so that they can get into the biotech industry. They want to go to the business school at UC San Diego because it's got a biotechnology focus. But if there's no jobs in that industry, or if the job growth is stagnant because all of those jobs are going offshore, there's going to be less students interested in science and less students in that curriculum, and they'll be studying other things. And so the cumulative effect of that basically is to reduce the scientific base of this country with all the implications that brings.
Now, my final question is, as China moves toward challenging the United States as the top economic player on the world stage, you know, the offshoring of biopharma research and manufacturing projects will probably not only continue, but will increase as well. What are your suggestions for making these business dealings with China and the U.S. and the rest of the world a win-win relationship rather than a zero-sum game?
Well, the big issue facing biopharma has to be counterfeiting and intellectual property theft. And until the system over there changes fairly dramatically, those risks are exceedingly high. I would suggest that anybody listening to this podcast who's considering offshoring would put other countries on their list to look at, whether it's Vietnam or India, because China is the worst of the worst. There's one other thing we haven't talked about, which I think is critical here, which is the broader geopolitical risk involved with conflict between the U.S. and China over trade, policy or over Taiwan or over any one of a number of things. We're not likely, the U.S. is not likely to go to war with India. It's not likely to go to war with Vietnam or Brazil or any other places where companies currently offshore. But there is some element of risk with China. So putting all your biopharma eggs in that basket is a mistake. So your question is, you know, what do we need to do to make it a win-win? I think that the biopharma companies need to be internationally diversified rather than an all-in-one Chinese basket. I think that they need to lead the charge regarding intellectual property protection. I think it's important that the industry basically ensures that China adheres to the same kind of rules that the rest of the world does for a lot of reasons.
I'm John Sterling. Thanks for listening. Now we'd like your thoughts on today's podcast. Please go to www.genincnews.com/blog and give us your opinion. We would also appreciate it if you would answer the following questions. Do you believe China adheres to its own set of rules in the international business arena, including its relationship with the global pharmaceutical industry? If so, what do you think needs to be done to ensure a more level playing field between China and biotechnology companies from other parts of the world? Bye for now.
To learn more about topics discussed in this GenCast, or to listen to previous GenCasts, visit our website at www.genengnews.com. New GenCasts are posted every week, Thursday, 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. For the Gen Publishing editorial staff, I'm Jonathan Ellinghouse, saying thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in again next week to the GenCast Network.